The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, night, good day. Greetings wherever and whenever you happen to be joining us here on this wonderful new edition of the Sunday Scotch Society. My name is Kyle Quincy Parker.
And I'm Matthew B. Kelly. How are you this fine day?
I'm splendid, thank you, Matthew. We are delighted to be co-hosting, co-piloting, sharing, talking, and listening duties together this episode. Matthew, I trust that you have been well, reasonably speaking, since the last time we spoke.
Better moderate.
That is better than some reports that that could be given. Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that you've been at least fair to moderate. Fair to middling is what they used to say back in the 18th century, 19th century. I myself have been fairly well. And I'm grateful that I am alive and healthy and well enough to share this this conversation with you. I'm looking forward to it. We are doing this the COVIDized way, the remote way, this conversation. Unfortunately, we are not in the same location. And so I have this wonderful bottle of single malt whiskey with me. It's the Jura 10-year-old. It's one of my favorite, sort of younger, single malt whiskeys. And, I'm looking forward to sipping it and chatting about it with you. But I'm also curious about what you, might be tippling.
Well, single malts are great, and people poo-poo blends quite a lot. However,
they do
today.
Unfortunate.
I am sipping a blend that is the Grand Old Par 18.
Ah, you! I recall you bringing the Grand Old Par to Whiskey Wednesdays. Was it the same 18-year-old that you brought?
No.
I think it was the 12, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So
I say that with some trepidation because my memory around those nights, let's say they take away the salient points. Sometimes not the finer details.
Well, yeah. I mean, sipping whiskey and smoking cigars with friends and talking. Well, I was going to say talking, whatever. But, you know, those conversations were... Yeah, I can imagine that salient detail might be all we remember from those. I look back on those with great fondness, actually. So the Grand Old Par 18. So tell me about it. Tell me what you know about that that wonderful whiskey.
Not a lot besides some past experience with it. So I haven't had this in over a year. So I'm actually looking forward to becoming reacquainted.
Excellent. Well, the Jura is one of those sort of, it's a newer whiskey. Jura is a newer distillery, and they make a whiskey that is finished in Oloroso sherry cask from Jerez in Spain, of course. And the sexiness is that it's matured for 10 years in American white oak ex bourbon barrels. And, you know, the American oak has a much different sort of flavor profile than the French oak, which is the other standard oak aging casks. And so what you got is this almost, well, American oak tends to give a little more vanilla overtones and a little sweeter overtone to whatever is aged in it. And especially given that that these barrels had bourbon in them, I'm looking forward to seeing how that sort of sweetness plays with the scotch. And the color here, you know, it's your typical sort of a copper gold color. And I'm going to do the thing in the grand tradition of the Sunday Scotch Society. And we will see what the nose will tell us. And then possibly we'll see what brand new things await us on the tongue. Oh, wow. Right away, I get the vanilla that I was talking about. A hint of citrus, like a rounder citrus, more like orange than lemon. I feel like unsweetened cocoa. Maybe some cracked pepper. Yeah, and of course a bit of the peat and smoke. That's kind of typical from the Jura distillery. I like the complexity of the nose on this one. I can definitely smell the American oak influence on the nose for sure. Lovely, lovely. What about the grand old par?
That was pretty round to me on the nose. I'm quite the fan of the color of this, but I could tell you, not much happening with the legs here. This is a this is more of a wash than a
coating thick, of the outside. Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's a simple on the nose, but I'm not picking out anything much in particular. There's a little bit of candied smell to it. But let's go in and see.
Yeah, all right. Well, I mean, we might as well taste it since we're already there, right? All right. You want to go first?
Just a little alcohol forward, not much.
I wouldn't have been able to
tell. No. That was more of a. that wasn't so much it than me having a little cough. But those cinnamon notes I get off of. Some of these scotches are more prominent here. Getting a bit of an earthy. I'm not going to assign peat to that, but a bit of an earthy development. I would say more so on the finish than on the palate. Overall, this is, you know, it's a solid little drink, but it's never going to be on the list, first of all. And secondly, I wouldn't call it complex. It's just for me right now, a solid blend that represents scotch pretty well. Very light caramel, slight smoke. I would just say serviceable. And would make a very good mixed drink.
I'm enjoying the Jura 10-year-old. It has some of the spices that you typically associate with things like fruitcake, right? It's candied fruit, there's ginger, there's some nuttiness there, maybe like toasted on. One of the things that I really enjoy is where on the nose I got that sort of unsweetened cocoa type chocolate type thing. On the tongue, that comes across as almost like a hint of coffee. And the vanilla is represented by a bit of a sweetness. One of the things that I really enjoy is, and this might just be me knowing where it's made, but there's almost a brininess to it, which I really enjoy. Jura Distillery is located on the island of Jura, which is in the Inner Hebrides, which is off the west coast of Scotland. So it's an island single malt whiskey. And I kind of feel like I could taste the sea spray. I feel, maybe, like I say, maybe it's just knowing where it's made. There's a bit of romance in there for me. But however that comes about, I'm really enjoying it. It's a great 10-year-old. It's not, you know, we're not talking about something that's going to knock your face in. You know, 40% alcohol by volume, which means it's only 80 proof. As opposed to the Balcones that we had the last episode, which was 53% alcohol by volume, a whole 106 proof. And I'm still shocked that you thought that was so smooth. But, you know, I mean, that's the beauty of how tastes work, you know. You like what you like, and you like it the way you like it. So, which is not to say that I didn't enjoy the Balcones. I just, it's a little hefty for me, a little sharp for me. I like strong whiskey, but I like it I like that strength to sneak up on me and not punch me in the face or punch me in the tongue.
I don't know why, but I didn't get that much. Yeah.
It's really cool. Actually, I didn't have to tell them. The person who introduced the Balcones to me listened to the pod, and they were like, they called me and like, this, he thought that was smooth. I was like, yeah, he did.
It surprised me.
Yeah.
But speaking of smooth, as this mellows out on the palate, on the finish, rather, I mean, I'm getting a little bit of a toffee developing there.
There you go. Yeah, and to me, that's one of the beautiful things about a good whiskey is that as you sit with it, as it sits with you, as it sits in the glass, and as your tongue and your taste buds acclimatize and you spend a little more time with it, new flavors develop, and it gets to be you know, a different experience as you go along. So I'm looking forward to seeing how these whiskeys develop as we have our conversation. And speaking of our conversation, we are on a journey as we're discussing third spaces or third places, as some, you know, however you choose to phrase it, those are the two names, third space or third place, for the phenomenon that we're discussing. And today, I kind of want to dig a little deeper and get down into specific third spaces or third places. But before we do that, I kind of want to reiterate the foundation for our conversation. As we're talking about the third space, is it relevant? And my proposition is that the necessity of third spaces, which I guess we can loosely define as neutral and informal gathering places that promote social interaction, has been well documented in modern society, both through sociological theory and empirical data. And it's the data part that I am excited about chopping up with you, because that's one of the things that I love about our conversations is opinion is great, but data is better. And the proof that I'm offering is the proof of my proposition is through an overview of the data and the evidence that supports the concept that third spaces are important. And one caveat before we jump off again is that no research on third spaces exists in the Bahamas that I could find. And I want to reiterate our challenge to the sociologists at the universities in town. The Sunday Scotch Society once again issues this challenge. Do the research on this. We will make sure you get it on the air. We will make sure people read your research. We will make sure that you have a platform to share the results of your research, whatever they may be. Okay. First things first, definitions. The concept of the third space or third place refers to an informal social environment outside of the home, which is considered the first space, or the workplace, which is considered the second, where people can gather and engage with others in neutral communal settings. These spaces include things like cafes and libraries or parks, and they promote social interaction, they foster community engagement, and they help build social capital. As I shared at the in the last episode, this is a concept that was popularized by a sociologist named Ray Oldenburg in a book, The Great Good Place. And in this book, he emphasizes the importance of third spaces for strengthening community ties and promoting civic life. And I think it's really one of the things that I guess I will want to lean into the conversation, lean into in the conversation is this idea of civic life. But to round out the definition section, the UN's definition from UNESCO of what makes a place a third place or a third space is that it's a neutral ground, which means you don't need an invitation and anyone can enter. It's unstructured. That means you can come and go as you please. It's not expensive. It's a place to talk, which means conversation is one of the main activities. And it's near your home or your workplace. Ideally, you can walk to your third place. It has regulars, but strangers aren't out of place. And chatter, joking, and teasing are an integral part of what makes a place a third place. As we lean into the data that's relevant to the third place that I want to talk about today, I want to reiterate a couple of those UN sort of defining characteristics. First, neutral ground. Meaning that you don't need an invitation and anyone can enter. I really want to lean in on the unstructured, which means you can come and go as you please. And I really want to lean in on the chatter, joking, and teasing being an integral part of the third space. And what I want to talk about, the specific third space that I really want to talk about is libraries. Before I jump into my research on the data, Matthew, I want to ask you, I know you have thoughts on third spaces, and I wonder what your thoughts on third spaces in general are, and libraries in particular, as to whether or not they are either relevant to the modern Bahamas or important in the grand scheme of things.
For sure. So here are some of my views, which may differ from how this is being defined in terms of what defines a third space and therefore its usefulness, etc., right? One of the things that we didn't get to in the last conversation was around a deeper discussion, and I don't want to take us off rails, but I want to mention community, right? Third spaces are about how some of those interactions occur. But for a very long time, I have held in my head a differentiation between a population that happens to work in the same area and a community. And the way that I differentiate this in normal conversation with people is when they bring up the idea of community, I bring up the idea of functional community. So let's just say, for instance, there's a performing arts community, right? The question for me is there a functional performing arts community? And there's no black or white answer on this, right? It's just
yes,
that
sir.
I don't think it's black or white.
Sorry,
these are shades of gray.
Yeah, all right, fine. Whatever.
But this entire idea and using performing arts as an example, right? It's not a space that you can come and go as you please. So perhaps a theater, as an example, or a film set is not a type of third space. But I think that any of these spaces come with rules. And I think we're going to get into that with the particular third space that you want to talk about this conversation. But I just want to bring up the idea of, hey, okay, first of all, this is about communities. And I think the importance for me about the third space is how it organically builds, even though the space may be designed towards this, but it organically builds functional community. And then the second thing is, there is a scale, a spectrum on which these spaces exist, right? And even, let's say, a barbershop, which I think is widely considered to be a third space, right? You come, go as you please, et cetera, et cetera. There are still rules around it, right? So it's not as if it's a meaning that it's unstructured makes it a free-for-all. And I think those are the main two points I want to make going in. The third thing, though, is I want to frame what you're talking about, data. You know I'm a nerd for it, and I'm all about it. But at the end of the day, data are not an end in and of themselves, right? And what we really want is, as we collect the data, is to get information out of it and produce knowledge and hopefully come to some wisdom. So I know you know, but I just want to say it for anyone who's listening. That's not the... When we hold data up, it's because it's on the path to perhaps being a little more wise in how we live.
I think it's a great caveat. I like that. I like that distinction. I think it's very necessary, especially in a conversation where we're challenging people to do research, which might seem like we are, and where I have already complained that there is no research and no data specific to our community on this subject and on this issue. I appreciate that caveat very much. So yeah, I think that's really great. So I want to talk about libraries, and I want to put a sort of a foundation down as to whether or not libraries are considered important in the general community of human beings that inhabit the globe. Since we don't have data from the Bahamas, I'm going to posit data from elsewhere, and we can extrapolate from that. And libraries play a role in terms of mental health and well-being. This is seen in the reported positive impact that libraries have on mental health. And the data shows that regular social interaction is linked to improved mental health. And a study in the American Journal of Public Health found that people who regularly engaged in social interactions at public places like cafes, parks, and community centers had lower rates of depression and anxiety. So third spaces then act as hubs for social engagement, contributing to mental well-being. And I think that's important in the context of a library, because as a library is still sort of considered a quintessential third space. But as you talk about the fact that there are rules associated with many of these spaces, I find that our conception of libraries fails in many regards to leave room for the social engagement aspect of the third space. I've seen some of it happening at the Harry Moore Library at UB, but I think that there is, the data suggests then that there is room for a greater level of social engagement. Third spaces also have a role in civic engagement and building social capital, as we talked about last episode. And I don't know if you remember, we cited the 2019 Knight Foundation report that talked about how communities with well-utilized third spaces like libraries exhibit higher levels of civic engagement, volunteerism, and voting participation. And that's because these spaces allow people to exchange ideas, engage in discussions, and mobilize around local issues. And again, the role of the library in that is often overlooked when we consider what libraries are important for. The obvious ones, sort of, are the educational and cultural impact that libraries have. You know, they're a classic example of the third space, and they promote educational equality. And this is important. The American Library Association did a study and found that public libraries provide critical resources and programs that support lifelong learning, particularly for marginalized populations who may lack access to formal education. Now, to me, the study seems to confirm what is clearly evident. But I think it's important that the data is there to support the policy direction that library directors and that at the state level, educational policymakers will have a scientific foot to stand on, rather than simply going according to their instinct and their feeling. And I'm not opposed to instinct and feeling leading your policy, but I think having data to support a direction gives a community a much firmer set of ground on which to walk.
I don't think we're in opposition here, but I want to make a distinction here. I don't think that the way that you phrase that, I would strictly agree in its technical sense. You said that it's good to have the data to support this decision, right? I think that it is good to have the data to support the decision-making process that would lead to whatever policy. Because otherwise, I might be being pedantic.
Confirmation bias. No, you're exactly. Right. Right? Confirmation bias is a real thing. Yeah, for sure. No, and I appreciate the distinction and the clarification. I suspect that what I wanted to say was better said by you. So I will strike what I said from the record and adopt the phrasing of my partner in crime.
I humbly accept.
On cultural enrichment, third spaces often serve as venues for cultural activities, including book clubs, art exhibits, and performances. And here, the study by the National Endowment for the Arts is relevant to me in that it found arts engagement in third spaces fostering greater cultural appreciation and helping to build a sense of belonging in diverse communities. Again, having been chastised, I do want to point out that there is a danger of confirmation bias in citing these studies, but I think the studies are relevant. But my issue is this. This whole conversation for me came about because a friend of mine was complaining about the fact that her 8-year-old son had never been to a library in his life, and that he had wanted to go into a library and been told that he could not go in because they weren't allowed to go into the library for whatever reason. And that made my friend irate, and she started asking me questions about libraries and when I last had been to one and where were they, et cetera, et cetera. And so the question that I have is, what the hell happened to libraries? Because when I grew up, you know, the library was a thing, not just at school, but there were libraries in the community. Every community had a library that was relatively close and accessible. But that does not seem to be the case now, number one. And number two, the libraries that are available don't seem to have made a transition to modern life. the latest books in the Nassau Public Library, the most recent books they have from the early 90s, if I remember correctly. We're in 2024 at this point, at the end of 2024. So what the hell happened?
Are you saying that the fiction from the 90s is not good enough for you, sir?
That is not at all what I'm saying, sir.
Okay, so you were expecting the Nassau Public Library. And apologies. I believe that one would have to have a passing familiarity with the Nassau Public Library to understand why I'm chuckling just a little bit, because it's a rather small place, and you know, it's just funny that it is the library. Not that there's anything wrong with it per se, but that it is verbally anyway the crown jewel is just funny to me. But you were expecting to have reference materials that are up to date there. Is that what you're saying?
That is precisely what I'm saying, yes.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah. Well, you know, facts, some facts change. Many facts do not change. Mm. So maybe that's it.
Mm. Okay. So on this issue... libraries. I'm not even going to engage in that. My proposition is that libraries remain highly relevant in the current digital and information-driven environment due to an evolving role in communities, education, and access to information. So I want to consider some reasons that libraries continue to play a vital role elsewhere. And as we look at these reasons, I want to consider whether or not there's any relevance to the Bahamas in what this data has to say about libraries in the modern age. On the question of equal access to information, in other countries, libraries provide access to technology, including computers and the internet, for individuals who may not have access at home. This is crucial in underserved communities where digital resources are often limited. And this is something that usually you hear discussed under the rubric of bridging the digital divide. I'm going to move on because I wanted to say something just now that would have gotten me in trouble. Free access to resources. Libraries offer free or low-cost access to books, academic journals, research databases, and other educational materials that would otherwise be expensive or inaccessible to the public. And again, I'm talking about libraries in developed or let's just say other communities or countries. Even to an extent, that's true here in the Bahamas, but moving on. On the issue of lifelong learning and education, libraries serve as learning hubs for students of all ages, providing study spaces, tutor programs, resources that complement school curriculums. And many libraries in other more developed countries offer homework help and access to academic databases. They also offer adult learning and skill development through a wide range of programs for adults, including literacy courses, computer skills training, career development workshops, and continuing education programs to help individuals improve their job prospects and personal growth. Where I see these things happening here in the Bahamas is in things like political constituency centers or constituency offices, or as an outgrowth of a civic society experiment. But none of it has sustainability or institutionalization that would have, those would be the main sort of advantages of seating those things in libraries, I would think. I'm pausing here for your thoughts.
I'm going to wait.
Okay. So let me get all the way to the end, and then you will come in and destroy my proposition. Fine. No problem. Digital resources and literacy. Modern libraries and other jurisdictions offer access to ebooks, audiobooks, online journals, and streaming services, allowing users to engage with content in new formats. Many libraries have extensive digital catalogs accessible from home, making resources available 24/7. And if there is a path forward for libraries in the Bahamas, to me, this must be the first step on that path. They also offer digital literacy programs through teaching essential digital literacy skills, like helping people navigate online resources, helping people learn to use software, how to stay safe online, and understand new technologies. This is crucial in our increasingly digital world, where many tasks require technological proficiency. I want to be clear that digital literacy is a sort of a buzzword, and UNESCO defines it as the ability to access, manage, understand, integrate, communicate, evaluate, and create information safely and appropriately through digital technologies for employment, decent jobs, and entrepreneurship. And it includes competencies that are variously referred to as computer literacy, ICT literacy, information literacy, and media literacy. So libraries often serve as meeting places where people can come together for events, workshops, and social interactions. In this way, they promote civic engagement, offering discussions on current issues, hosting public forums, and acting as gathering spaces for local organizations. They also often offer diverse programming such as author talks, cultural exhibitions, language courses, and creative workshops. To me, this is important community work, and it places libraries at the center of public spaces for community engagement and cultural programming. Libraries also offer support for research and innovation, where they play a critical role in teaching information literacy, helping users discern credible sources and evaluate information effectively. This skill is increasingly important in an age of misinformation. And once again, I want to be clear on the definition of the terms that we're using. The Association of Colleges and Research Libraries defines information literacy as a set of integrated abilities encompassing the reflective discovery of information, the understanding of how information is produced and valued, and the use of information in creating new knowledge and participating ethically in communities of learning. It's defined somewhere else, which I think is maybe a little simpler, as the ability to find, evaluate, organize, use, and communicate information in all its various formats, most notably in situations requiring decision-making, problem-solving, or the acquisition of knowledge. Libraries, as teachers of this skill, information literacy, I think are incredibly important, especially as people are growing up as quote-unquote digital natives. And we complain all the time about how people are stuck in their own echo chambers and how easy it is to derive all your information from one source, and to therefore have an increasingly and almost irretrievably skewed view of reality, the world in which you live. And I think information literacy is an incredibly important skill to cultivate to try and combat that particular, I guess we'll call it malaise. So in more developed countries, the libraries are now offering maker spaces where users can access tools like 3D printers, like design software, and other cutting edge technology to explore creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship. And speaking of entrepreneurship, these libraries also provide resources for business research, and they offer workshops on entrepreneurship and support local economic development by helping startups and small businesses access critical information. And given our recent national focus on small business, I think this role is crucial for whatever our libraries evolve into, if our libraries do in fact evolve, which I really hope. So my first conclusion on this is that considering the roles libraries play in other countries where they remain essential in the digital age by providing equitable access to information, by fostering lifelong learning, by promoting digital literacy, by serving as vital community and cultural centers, I think it's to the benefit of the Bahamas to reinvest in our library spaces. Their ability to adapt to technological changes while maintaining their traditional roles ensures their continued relevance and importance. I believe I would like to say, quod erat demonstrandum, thus it is proved, I have made my point.
Yeah, so how's that going for you?
I enjoyed it. I hope you did too.
No, I don't mean the actual. I mean, your position is quite reasonable. But, you know, what is the actual truth on the ground in terms of not only how many libraries there are, but, you know, how are they accessed? What are the programs around them, et cetera, et cetera? You believe we should invest. Okay, great, sure. But like what if any info do you have from on the ground? I have my own little anecdotes.
Mm-hmm.
But
so,
you know, how's it going out there?
It's not going well. It's not going well. The majority of our library resources are so we have to look at this in a couple of different ways. All schools have libraries in some fashion or another, whether or not we're talking about a well-funded, well-stocked library or not, there is a library on every school campus. The fact that those libraries are for the use of the student body and not the community at large is, I think, a relevant piece of data for us to consider as we're thinking about the situation on the ground. When we talk about community libraries, there are some libraries that are under the purview of the government through the Ministry of Education. And I don't want to preempt our conversation with Dorcas, who is the officer in charge of libraries, and that she's agreed to come on the show and talk about the state of affairs and what is needed in terms of public libraries in the Bahamas. But one of the things that she said to me in our background conversation was that without commenting on the current state of the library system, the need for investment in public libraries is beyond great or urgent. So I would say that the situation on the ground is that we have a history of libraries being important in our community. I personally used the Nassau Public Library to study for my GCE O-levels in the 1980s. I think I might have been among the last generation of students to actually use that place as a study hub. That was where my mother dropped me, or my father dropped me, for the weeks leading up to my O-levels, so that I could prepare myself to accomplish whatever I accomplished. And while I was there, I certainly was able to take advantage of both the fiction and the nonfiction offerings. But having lived in the U.S. for 15 years, let me tell you about night and day in terms of what libraries mean in a community that actually gives a rip about them. All of the things that I have highlighted from the research that I did, I was very careful to only include things that I had personally seen myself in my 15-year sojourn in the U.S. I lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I lived in New York, Harlem specifically. I lived in Rockville, Maryland, and worked in Washington, D.C. And in each of those places, the libraries in the public system, or those libraries that were attached to educational institutions but were open to the public, fulfilled all of the roles that I've outlined in this conversation. So I am of the view that we're not asking for a reinvention of the wheel when we talk about, say, or when I suggest that investing in libraries in our country, particularly the public library system, is a worthy investment. I think the evidence is there to be found. And I think the need for them is there to be demonstrated. That's why I think we agreed to issue a call for research to be done in this community. Because while it seems sound reasoning and sound logic to me to suggest that we need public libraries urgently and desperately, that might just be because that's how I feel. So let's see some research. As far as anecdotal evidence based on what's on the ground, we might as well. Once again, I was going to go too far. Yeah, we desperately need investment in our library system in the Bahamas.
Indeed. I mean, without resources behind it, there's not a lot that we could say that's very actionable, like even just like pressuring people to do certain things. If there's not going to be a commitment of resources, then, you know, I could row our soon-to-be guest about all sorts of things, but they can't do anything about it.
So my question for you is not whether you want to row our guest. My question...
I won't, by the way, but...
Yeah, if you do, you do. It doesn't matter to me. My question to you is whether or not you buy the proposition that investing in libraries is a necessity for the modern Bahamas.
Yeah. Look, even if we, and it is not the truth, but let's say that we take that access to the internet, which is so widespread now, as to be ubiquitous, gives access to all the information that one would need, right? There's still the question of the quality, the training that you mentioned, to just be able to discern what you should be listening to and how to decipher media, et cetera, and on, right? But the bigger issue is to have physical space in communities to be able to stitch ourselves together in such a fashion where we have free access to information and each other and possibilities beyond where we're at now, right? The problem with the black mirror in your hand is that it's just you and it, and you're in isolation. And the promise of the third space as a library is that you could bring that into a context where you're not lost, and everyone around you has a chance to connect with you as you do to them. So, you know, I'm completely on board here. It's just a matter of, I don't feel that many people know the possibilities of libraries, because even by the time I came along, they were not very used.
That's my concern.
And they certainly have not evolved.
Oh, for sure. You touch on my major worry, which is that people will think that this is not relevant because they've had no experience with a library.
Listen,
that can
even
be transformative.
Yeah, and even if they don't have a love of learning and immersing oneself in other people's experience, which is essentially what any story is, and it doesn't have to be fiction. It's a lot of nonfiction like that as well. Even without that, right? Access to community spaces, period, to be able to do anything, a workshop or makerspace, et cetera, is so important. And I don't know that you could justify budget-wise any other way for such spaces to just exist. Like, I think the modern library, certainly in the Bahamas, has to be this super multifaceted thing that is really there, not just for access to information, but again, what is the end thing? We're not just looking for data, information, knowledge. We want the wisdom of how to live better, how to have better lives, how to have better communities, etc. And I don't see how you could leave libraries out of that. And I think we need that public space to be physically there. Yeah, but you know, I don't, even within the government, you know, they know how important libraries were to their journeys, but you know, you don't hear any politician get up and talk about libraries.
Yeah, yeah. You're 100% correct. So anyway, I bring this to the public square with the hope that our conversations might stir some wider conversations, and that ultimately we will be able to create enough of a conversation in the community that the policymakers recognize that this is something that Bahamians value, and that therefore this is something worth investing in at a national level. Now, if it turns out that we just scream it into the void and nobody cares, then that, you know, that is an answer in itself. But I have to believe that once people bring this to the front of mind, that we cannot continue to exist with the deterioration of such an important and critical resource as the public library, which I think is possibly one of the most important tools in our arsenal to modernize not only our education and culture, but our entrepreneurship and pretty much everything else about the way we live.
Well, I'll leave you with this tiny ray of hope, which may be empty, but hey, it's a glimmer. The Easton Public Library, which has been closed for, it feels like 4 years, but it's probably closer to three. There has been some construction work finally going on. You know, it's been closed for renovations for years. And, you know, before that, you couldn't get in anyway because of COVID. So maybe that means that it's going to reopen within the next 5 years. Or maybe it means that they're renovating it for some government office. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, we will see. I will choose to be hopeful rather than cynical. and we will see. And speaking of being hopeful, you worried about my segue. Speaking of being hopeful, I got a call the other day and somebody sent me a link. And I just want to say, I'm so proud of my friend Therese Turner-Jones. Therese, so the article came through, the link was a link to an article or a blog that was written about the need to support women's leadership in the Caribbean. And the blog writer mentioned the fact that Therese, who's an economist and strategic thinker with over 25 years' experience in the region, is currently vying with two men for the position of the president of the Caribbean Development Bank, which I think is incredible. And the blog writer points out that Therese would be the first woman in 54 years to even be nominated for the position. An announcement we made on October 10th. If I remember correctly, she had an interview on the 4th of October. That would have been Friday past. And I am keeping my fingers crossed that the next time I see her, I will have to call her Madam President. And just by way of information on who Therese Turner-Jones is, at present, she is the acting vice president of operations at the Caribbean Development Bank. She's been the director of projects there for over a year. Before that, she was an economic research and development specialist at the Inter-American Development Bank. She was also the general manager of the Caribbean department of the IDB for 4 years, almost five. She was a country representative for Jamaica for more than 8 years for the IDB. Prior to that, she was the deputy division chief at the International Monetary Fund. She had been at the IMF for more than 20 years. So Therese is I don't know how else to say that. She's amazing. A Bahamian by birth. She spent more than a decade in Jamaica, where she, made a mark as a GM, general manager for the Caribbean and country representatives at the IDB, as I mentioned. And it is critically important that Bahamians in these spaces get supported. And so I call on everyone who's listening to make sure that they support Teresa on this. If phone calls need to be made, make those phone calls. If emails need to be sent, send those emails. Because this is a once in a lifetime opportunity for a Bahamian, and I think we can safely throw our support behind Therese Turner Jones for the presidency of the Commonwealth of the Caribbean Development Bank. Matthew, the Jura has settled down, and it is all the flavors have melded into an overall sort of sweetness with a bit of smoke. None of the flavors are particularly pronounced at this point. It's just a little fruity, a little sweet, a little smoky. It tastes good. As usual, I'm having it neat. And I feel like if you see a bottle of the Jura 10-year-old, it's definitely something that that you should snag. I'll try to have a bottle for us for when we do the show live together again, so that we can drink it together.
Look forward to it. The Par 18 has mellowed out. That toffee is certainly up to the top, but I'm especially enjoying this nice little tingle. So, cheers, my friend.
Sláinte, my brother. Thank you for your time and energy. Thank you for indulging me to talk about libraries and to talk about Therese. I look forward to the next time we get together to do this, my brother.
As do I.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Sunday Scotch Society. And as I say on every occasion, does that
Yeah,
obia.
yeah. Ciao.
Check it out.